My talk this morning, I was going to keep very much to assessments. I haven't touched very much on the treatments, and particularly I haven't touched very much on mirror visual feedback, so I'll be very happy to talk about any of that in the panel discussions. We've already seen a picture of Descartes, and Descartes always turns up at any pain conference, and I just love his phrase, "I think, therefore I am." But recently I came across a far better phrase, which I think particularly depicts what goes on in complex regional pain syndrome. And this was from another philosopher a little bit later on than Descartes. And I think we're into "I feel, therefore I am." And I think that's what we need to really get from our patients about how they feel and learn from their descriptions in order for us to find the appropriate treatments for them. Now, Silas Weir Mitchell was the person who first described this condition, and he talked very much about causalgia. And I've just got a little reading from his original documents, which I think just bear home the intense pain that these patients feel. And this was from a soldier who'd had a bullet wound through just above his elbow. And it says, "On the second day, the pain began. It was burning and darting. He states that at this time, sensation was lost or lessened in the limb, and that paralysis of motion came on in the hand and forearm. The pain was so severe that to touch anywhere or shaking the bed or a heavy step caused it to increase." He then talks about 2 years later, he meets the same individual. He keeps his hand wrapped in a rag, wetted with cold water and covered with oiled silk, and even tucks the rag carefully under the flexed fingertips. Moisture is more essential than cold. Friction outside of the clothes at any point of the entire surface shoots into the hand, increasing the burning pain. Deep pressure on the muscles has a like effect, and he will allow no one to touch his skin, save with a wetted hand, and even then is careful to exact careful manipulation. So we can see that this is intense pain. We have criteria, which some feel are helpful, others don't. You can simply see that there's two types. Type one, where there may be spontaneous pain following minor trauma, and then type two, where there's no nerve injury. And interestingly, type two has a more regionally confined area, and you very definitely do see that clinically. The problem with these criteria is that they are somewhat vague and somewhat woolly. And in order to do research in these patients, it's very difficult to know whether you've just got a chronic pain syndrome or whether you generally have complex regional pain syndrome. So over the last few years, people have been trying to tighten them up, and there have been a number of suggestions on how to revise those, both for clinical assessment and for research. And you can see just on these that the research criteria are slightly tighter. But even when we apply these, and we have a little checklist in clinic, we still have a little section called NOS, which is just really not sure. This seems to be something very similar to CRPS. It doesn't meet the criteria. We would treat it like CRPS, but it isn't quite the same. And if you remember nothing else from this talk, and I always think, you know, go to all these conferences, don't you? And you remember about one thing the next day. But please remember that these patients come under a general criteria, but they are hugely individual. And I think we need to make sure that our treatments are tailored individually to them. So this is a little bit of what it looks like. And you can see that it can give you severe deformities. This lady had a spontaneous onset of pain, and this was 7 years down the road. And she can really have very minimal use from her affected left hand. This guy here just lost the top of his middle finger in an industrial accident. And within weeks, his arm had performed this extraordinary distortion. And in fact, soon after, his foot did a similarly bizarre twist. So it can have serious impacts. The incident rate seems to vary hugely. In fact, there have been very few epidemiological studies in this condition. Both of them, the first was conducted in the States, and the second more recently in the Netherlands. And just from looking at routine clinic notes and general rheumatology clinics in the UK, we would say that we're probably closer at the higher number, at 26.2, than we are at the lower end. And we were just very intrigued to find that actually our incidence of rheumatoid arthritis was pretty close to that of CRPS, which surprised us. Onset of symptoms can be following trauma, but equally people do turn up with it spontaneously, and they're not making it up. It does just happen. So we will have a patient who wakes up on a Tuesday morning and finds that her fingers are a bit tingly. By the end of the week, she would meet the full criteria for CRPS in that hand. So spontaneous very definitely happens. The figures of how many go on to get chronic symptoms does vary, and there's literature that says anybody who has a fracture of the wrist, about 30%, will meet the diagnostic criteria of CRPS 6 weeks after that event. But in fact, by a year, only about 1% have the chronic symptoms. But if you go on this 50% suffer chronic symptoms and take the ISP definition of chronic pain, then that's probably a little bit misleading. Within a year, the majority do recover. We've already seen from the criteria that you have a range of problems. You definitely have changes in sensory perception, motor and autonomic signs, and the most confusing thing for the patient is that these can fluctuate on an hourly basis, not just over a day, and particularly in medico-legal claims, this can be a real problem of disbelief. Our other biggest problem is that we get a lot of referrals and say, we're sending you a patient with chronic regional pain syndrome, and lo and behold, somebody turns up with something similar to fibromyalgia. And the more we can lobby to get, the name clearer somehow, but there seems to be an interchangeable nomenclature between chronic and complex, and they clearly are quite different. So it's vital that we stick to complex regional pain syndrome so that we all know what we're talking about. These patients find diagnosis very difficult, and quite a typical scenario is they'll be seen by the orthopaedic surgeon following that fracture that doesn't seem to have resolved as quickly as the patient expected. And the orthopaedic surgeon looks at it and says, no, your x-rays are great, there's no reason for ongoing pain. And he may decide to do just another little surgical intervention to see if that pain will sort, and lo and behold, the pain gets worse. And by this point, the patient's describing some quite bizarre things, which seem very abnormal to an orthopaedic surgeon. So they say, oh, well, I might send you to the pain clinic, or perhaps the psychologist might be able to help you here. And 2 or 3 years later, this patient may eventually arrive at somewhere who understand the condition. So being disbelieved is their biggest problem. And again, I'd really stress, listen to them and just acknowledge the symptoms that they're experiencing. Now, the other really fascinating thing to do with these people is just get them to shut their eyes and describe to you how they perceive their limb. And what we tend to do is start at a limb that isn't affected at all. And so if it's upper limb, as in this lady's case, just shut their eyes and just say, okay, tell me how you see your feet. And it sounds a ridiculous question, don't you? So shut your eyes, tell me how you see your feet. And there'll be a look of perplexion on these people's faces. And then they'll say, well, they're normal, they're fine, there's nothing different. And you work your way up their body until you eventually come to the area that you're really interested in. And you may be quite surprised that before you get to that point, as was this lady, I said, so tell me about your shoulders. And again, a bit of a confused expression. He said, well, actually, he said, my left shoulder feels huge, much, much bigger than my right. And then you go down her arm and she says, I haven't really got an elbow on the left. It's not there at all. In fact, I haven't really got a lower arm. But there is this massive hand at the end of it. And if these patients draw those pictures, you'll find that whole sections of those limbs can be missing. And I've put here some lovely pictures that Ronald Melzack's produced of amputees and their descriptions of limbs. And you can see the shaded areas are the bits that they still perceive. And then obviously the firmer lines are where their residual limb is. CRPS patients will give you almost identical descriptions. There are parts of those limbs that are still there and the whole section's missing. But the parts that are there are either much, much bigger or much, much smaller. Still with their eyes closed, you can ask them to try and tell you which finger you're touching. And Fodorota first wrote this up in pain not long back, and we found that it's absolutely replicable in our clinics. And you'll find that in the affected limb, they will have a merging of those fingers. It feels like a mitt. So they've got a thumb, but they haven't really got the fingers. Very confused about which finger you're touching, quite often unaware that you're touching anything. And we've described that quite a little while ago now, where we took 15 patients and found that about a third of them reported these referred sensations. And this lady, you'll remember from the earlier slides, so when we saw her at 7 years, when you touched her here, she felt it on her face. When you touched her on her face, it came back to the hand, and likewise just here at her shoulder. If you touched her with a neurotip, it was sharp in her hand, and she really disliked it. And if you just brush the cotton bud up and down here, you'll feel a brushing up here. So it's modality specific. And we weren't the first to describe this in any patients. This has been well reported in the amputees, and we just referred it on to the CRPS folk because we're increasingly thinking these are so similar to our phantom limb patients. So this was a gentleman who lost his right hand, and when he shaved in the morning, he was much more aware of the pain and the phantom sensations in his right hand. And when you mapped out on the right side of his face, then he perceived that in his fingers and could tell you exactly which finger you were touching when you touched him on his face. Trickle water down his face. Ramachandran has some lovely descriptions of these. He felt water trickling down his hand. There's, fortunately for us, some fantastic imaging data that's been done since we first published our work, which shows that indeed the sensory cortex starts to remap. And this slide here shows patients with right upper limb CRPS. When they're touched on their thumb and their finger, you can see that on the left-hand side, they have a normal distribution between the two digits. But on the right, they've started to become closer. And it seems that the sensory map shrinks, but the motor map, Meyhofner's done some great work recently, really fantastic paper published last year, which shows that the motor map starts to enlarge. So you can see already that the sensory motor things are starting to become important. How this probably happens is that this is your sensory cortex, and we will all have links that exist between all these body parts, which are normally suppressed. When you have normal information coming in, these areas remain isolated from the areas adjacent to them. But lo and behold, if you lose a limb, or if you start to get a change in sensation to that limb, these links waken up, and the hands starts to be lost because the face starts to encroach on that area and the upper arm starts to encroach, which is why you get from the hand to the face, and you'll also get exactly the same from the knee to the foot. And you'll also find that people with CRPS in their foot will report quite a lot of urogenital problems, bladder disturbances, which is hugely investigated but very likely to be a referred sensation, effectively a CRPS of the bladder. So the motor assessment is very important in these patients because they do have gross abnormalities, and we're only just sort of getting to grips with how subtle some of those are as well. So this lady obviously had a reduced grip strength and very limited range of movement at her wrist. But bizarrely, when you got her to ask her to move that hand, there was almost, you could see the cogs turning. It took her a while to just engage with that hand, to even know where it was. And it was a very slow process. If you got her to shut her eyes and ask her to now imagine doing that movement, imagine flexing and extending her wrist, she could do it perfectly. And she found it really quite exciting. She said, well, no, I can do that. It doesn't give me any pain. I can imagine moving it up and down. Now, other patients, you'll find that isn't the case. They come to imagine a movement and they just cannot even contemplate it because the pain becomes so great just thinking about moving that limb. But if you work up to the next joint up and you say, okay, can you imagine moving that joint? You'll quite often find that the region that's affected, again, you can locate where you are. And so sometimes you'll find that the elbow equally, they can't move in their imagination, but the shoulder's fine. So you start to know where you need to target your therapies. If they can perform imagined movement, that's where we'll start and start to get them to think about moving their limb, just shifting it in their mind's eye. And they quite often find it quite relaxing. It's quite nice. It relieves the stiffness. It's easy to do. The other thing that we do, we assess them with a mirror. And since we published our work on using mirror as a treatment, we now use it probably much more in our assessment. And what we would do is position it just like this patient here. And in fact, ideally, they'll be looking around to see into the mirror. And we'd get them to perform bilateral synchronized movements. And that's what we ask them to do. And you'll find that sometimes patients perform those beautifully, and they'll have their affected limb hidden behind here, so that they're seeing a normal limb and its reflection. But sometimes you'll look behind that mirror, And you and the patient are completely convinced that they're moving that arm, but actually it's not going anywhere. And we call that motor extinction. The arm isn't moving. They have no concept where that limb is when they can't see it. So mirror visual feedback in these cases is a non-starter, because all you're doing is exacerbating the problem. And I'll show you a little bit about the mechanisms on how that would happen. So if that occurs, don't start a mirror visual feedback and go to imagined movements. If they can't do imagined movements, then you need to be working much more on Lorimer Mosley's excellent program of getting to look at pictures. Having said that, we've also found cohorts of patients where looking at pictures just exacerbates their problems. Limb laterality exacerbates their problem. And we need to keep working back along that motor planning pathway. And again, it reiterates the fact there are subgroups of these patients. We can't treat them all the same. While I'm on this subject, these patients have big mirrors. When we did this work, I didn't want anybody to make any money out of it. I didn't want anybody to be flogging mirror boxes. And I know this is hugely controversial, but they need big mirrors, somewhere cheap, somewhere easy, back of the wardrobe, where you can see the whole arm, the whole leg. A little poxy mirror box is not going to work. So these well documented the motor abnormalities in these patients. They have a slower response in the limb laterality tasks. Imagined movements can cause an increase in swelling, increase in pain. There are a range of unpleasant tremors, myoclonus, dystonias, all of which are very difficult to treat. They have this slowness. If you get them to do a repetitive movement, like sort of doing a piano, they become slower and slower and slower at it. It's fascinating. And yet they feel they should be able to control it, and it's very frustrating. It seems that the problems increase with the disease duration. Say there's well-documented evidence of motor planning dysfunction within the central networks, spinally and within the brain. And you can see that if they are given a particularly difficult motor task, it has been shown that there's increased activity in the anterior cingulate, and it's possibly that loop is how it connects to the autonomic nervous system. And as I've already said, Myhofen has shown that there's remapping in the motor cortex. So just a little summary of the sorts of things you should be looking for in these patients. And there's a lot. I do an hour assessment, and I realise that's a big luxury to have. So there are motor and sensory problems in these patients, and frequently they're disbelieved. And particularly the area about amputation, they won't have mentioned that to somebody before. They won't have mentioned that when they actually look at the limb, they're seeing something completely different to what you're seeing. So you have to take care. And luckily, the clinical and the imaging evidence is starting to grow, which just show us that there are central changes. So how do changes in the sensory and the motor system develop into pain? How can it possibly be? And this is purely a theoretical model, but we're gradually testing it within clinical and imaging studies. And the model that's suggested here is that this is how our motor and sensory systems talk to each other. So if you go to pick up, let's say I go to pick up this book, before I pick it up, I need to have a rough idea about what the weight of that book's going to be. Will it hurt me? Will it cause me problems? And because I've picked up that book before, I've got a prearranged idea about how it's going to feel. And so I pick it up, and it all works very smoothly. But what if somebody unbeknown to me had put a lead weight in the middle of that book, and you pick it up, and there's this element of surprise, isn't there? It's not what you expected to happen. And so you look down at it and you look to see what the problem is so that you can correct your sensory feedback. And the way that it works is before you do a movement, you rely on a huge amount of baseline information, your previous experience, where you know your joints are in space, your sensory input at that time. And before you do that movement, you have a pretty rough idea of what you're going to feel when you do that movement. And you make a guesstimate of the sensory consequences. And that's what's called your efference copy. You then perform the movement, and you get actual sensory feedback. And you compare your guesstimate and what actually happens. And I say most of the time we get it right. We've all done that when you run down a flight of stairs and the bottom step's a little bit shorter, and there's this surprise element. So then, if there's a discrepancy, you come back and you update your baseline information. so that we're constantly aware, we're constantly safe. And that's the most crucial thing about this system. Your motor and your sensory system are ensuring that you are in a safe environment, that you're able to get out of a situation easily. Now, if I got you all to just shut your eyes and take yourselves off to the swimming pool and just imagine swimming. Now, some of you are non-swimmers and you'll have, I've lost you already. Others of you will have been up at crack of dawn this morning and done 50 laps up and down the pool. And I want you to think about the sounds that you would have heard, the feeling of the water, and the movement that you would have had in those limbs. And some of you will be very good at this, and some of you can imagine it. And you'll all have a certain feeling of what it feels like. But none of you have actually moved at all. But you've worked your way through that imagination. And all the areas that you would have moved have become activated. So there's a really crucial point in here of simulation, motor simulation. And then an external influence inhibits it, so that you don't actually perform it. And you would attribute that to yourself. I was talking to somebody last night about schizophrenics. They do this, but they attribute it to somebody else. So they'll attribute it to the television, and voices are talking to them from the television. So this is a crucial stage in your motor planning. So what happens when the whole thing goes wrong? So we can confuse our motor and sensory systems remarkably easily. I've already given you some everyday activities, but what I want you to do is when you go home tonight, you open your wardrobe doors and you get those cheap IKEA mirrors, and you do yourself a little party trick. And you put your hands by the side so you can't see one, and move them up and down and in a congruent manner. You look in the mirror and you can just see one, and you can see your other hand moving up and down nicely. And everything will probably feel not too bad, because your motor output, you're moving in the same direction, your sensory feedback, you're seeing what you're expecting. But then you do them in mismatching, incongruent movements. So motor output says you're doing this. Sensory feedback is still telling you, just as this bottom one is, that you've got two hands moving in the same way. Do that for 20 seconds, and the 40 healthy controls that we had, 60% of them start to feel quite unpleasant sensations in the arm they couldn't see. And these were fit, healthy people. So some of them felt that in their hand, it started to become cooler or warmer. Others felt that there was a pins and needles. And for some, there was a definite pain. 20 seconds was far too long. They didn't want to continue. They had a reduced awareness of their limb, as in they would find that the limb that they couldn't see was sort of floating around a little bit. They weren't really sure when they stopped where that limb was. Others felt that they, in fact, had three limbs. So they had the one they could see, the one in the mirror, and then there was this third one. And you could alter people's body perception just through this very simple trick. And they had very poor motor control. They just could not locate that limb sufficiently to do a smooth movement. So for some, it really came quite stiff. So just 20 seconds, you can induce a range of abnormal sensations in fit, healthy people. Give them their vision back, perform congruent movements, and lucky for us, it all went okay. So whereabouts in this model could CRPS fit? So we already know that there's a mismatch between the representation on the sensory cortex and the representation on the motor cortex. So your baseline information is corrupted right at the start. When you're sending out that guesstimate of what's going to happen, you've already got a problem, because things aren't as you expect. And we know the patient doesn't perceive that, because when they shut their eyes and describe that limb to you, it's very different to what you and they are actually seeing. When they do an imagined movement, again, they're going to have a pretty rough idea of what they should be perceiving. But if it's not what they expect, they're going to start to generate problems. And finally, if they perform those movements, then they will start to generate a sensory discrepancy. So our treatments need to be targeted at these three spots. And there's some wonderful work done by Herta Flohr in the phantom limb pain patients on discrimination training. And we're starting to try exactly that in CRPS. And to a certain extent, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, are exactly what they've been doing here. getting increased body awareness, getting people to use their limbs. We need to work on this section, on that imagine movement. And Laura Ramosi has done fantastic work advancing that. But as I say, we need more done there because we haven't got it quite cracked yet. And then we've put mirrors down this end to try and give you what is perceived as good sensory feedback to try and correct it here. Finally, and I promise it will be finally, we think we might actually be seeing changes a little bit lower than we thought before. And this is purely a hypothetical model. But some of you may be familiar with these slides. If your four-year-old came home with a picture of a horse that looked like this, you'd be pretty chuffed, wouldn't you? You'd say, gosh, yeah, that's great, it's got four legs, it sort of looks roughly like a horse, and you'd be very proud of them. If your four-year-old came home with a picture like this, you'd be pretty frightened. But that's exactly what the autistic savants can do, and this is a picture of a horse by a four-year-old. Now, autistic savants are not complicated, their thinking's not complicated by conceptualization. They still see the basic building blocks, so they still have access to perspective and all those other sorts of things, which we will just bring together to give us an overarching picture. And perhaps it is that in our CRPS patients, they're starting to get access to those evolutionary earlier models of a limb, where you did have a much larger hand, but perhaps a foreshortened forearm. And likewise, autotomy, where a lizard in hot Mediterranean countries, and you go to reach for it, and it sheds its tail. And that's almost exactly what you're seeing in CRPS. The body wishes to disown that limb. And the more it disowns it, the greater the problems are. But finally, they have this increased peripersonal space, as we showed with conflict allodynia. Start to approach them and their pain increases. And we know from the animal literature that monkeys are able to extend their peripersonal space by using tools. And the whole thing is that you need to be able to extend it so that you perceive that this now becomes your hand and you can manipulate it very carefully. And that tallies very nicely with central changes that happen with the use of tools. This pig, she will be constantly aware of where her little piglets are. No matter how far they move away, she will just bring them back, although she looks as if she's asleep the whole time. So we can do this. We can extend the area that we perceive. So as I've said, I think we've got three targets for CRPS. And we're getting there, but we've still got a lot more to do. So we can correct this sensory discrepancy and reduce their pain. But we need to work right back here, and within this system, but also with that visual system as well, which is very powerful. So we've seen that sensory motor systems are important, and they have to work in partnership. If we have a discrepancy between them, we start to generate problems. But we need to get good physiotherapy, occupational therapy, to try and target those discrepancies. At the RNHRD, we do run a tertiary referral centre where we have an inpatient program for those with CRPS, and we do take quite a lot of referrals from Scotland. We have very good air link down to Bristol, so we're pretty efficient at this now. But we will offer people within that 2-week stay daily physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, occupational therapy, mirror visual feedback and education. And it's not a cure, and we really stress that. This is to teach people the skills that they need to use to go out and continue their rehab. I'd really like to just stress this UK CRPS network. I'd be thrilled to hear from anybody within the audience who would like to come and join us, who has an interest in CRPS, because I don't think we have anybody from Scotland. I think we've got a single therapist from Scotland. And when we discharge patients back out to the world, we really need therapists and doctors who are interested in this condition to continue on their care. So it would be wonderful to talk to you. We meet about 3 times a year, and we're a mixture of academics and clinicians who are keen to do multi-centre studies, so I'd be very happy for anybody to get in touch. My email address is down here, and just want to acknowledge we are very much a multidisciplinary team. We have psychologists, OTs, physios, and we all contribute greatly. And also thank you to all those who fund us. Thank you very much for your time.